the Edge with April Mahoney Brains. Here, this is the place where the conversation is pointed, the guests are sharp, and the responses are never dull. Welcome home, Brains.
Coming to you straight from San Diego, California, let's welcome our host, April Mahoney.
Right every time. We get it right all the time because we are together here on the Edge, okay?
Absolutely.
That's here right. We are. This is the place, Brains. Right here, this is the spot. You done check back in where the conversation is pointed, the guests are sharp, and the responses are never dull. Today, our guest is Jenny Goff from Canada. She is an environmental engineer. That's right. Cheers. We was talking Cheers. About that. See, everybody don't get a cup. He's a limited edition, baby. You can't buy these. How about that?
No, that's right. They're for brains.
Really? So she's a brain. And we're going to talk about the work that she does with the environment. She's done some unusual stuff. I'm going to tell you about that. But she's also a budding author in her fourth attempt to rewrite the perfect book. And she laughs about that, but I told her, I said, it's like giving birth. Well, maybe not this time, because I don't think you have to try four times to give birth. This comes
out. One would hope not.
Exactly. But you know what? It is giving birth to your words, to your thoughts, to your creativity. And when you write a book, you're not writing it for you. You're writing it for the reader. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. She's going to give us some great environmental tips. I'm going to talk to her about what in the world is fracking. What does that do to the environment? We're going to talk about what happens up under the sea, all of that waste that we're throwing away, and what can we do to save the planet? Because as she explained to me, some things are just irreversible, but what can we do to sustain it? So help me welcome her to the Edge, Miss Jenny Goff. Hi, baby.
Thank you so much, April. I'm honored to be here, and I'm grateful to be your guest. So thank you so much for having me on your show. And as you mentioned, I'm an environmental engineer and the chairman of the International Association of Environmental Professionals. I think that's something that we haven't talked about.
Wow. And I'm also you sit at the table, girl.
Yeah. I sit at the head of the table for that one.
Wow. Yeah.
And I'm also an author. So I'm writing a book about authenticity. So we'll talk about all those things. We've got lots of time, right?
We sure do. Because time is a mere illusion anyway, and it seems to have stopped right now with this COVID. Let's start with that.
Well, I have to disagree. I think time is like, I'm a scientist, so time is a finite unit of measure.
You believe that? I believe it's an illusion that somebody came up with to track us.
Yeah, I do believe, you know, in units of measure.
And I get it. So you're going to take me there too. But tell us a little bit about, let's start with your beginnings. How in the world did you become a environmental engineer?
Well, that goes all the way back sort of to my childhood. I've always loved the environment. I went actually through for chemical engineering as an undergrad degree and discovered that I really loved the environmental component of my work. So that's the direction that I pursued. I see you combing your hair, April.
Now you messed up the recording. We got to do it again. When you see me doing things, the screen is totally focused on you. Just keep on going because I'll adjust the lights and all that kind of stuff. Because when I'm looking at the screen and I see it, I don't like it. And so then I put the screen totally on you. So now we got to do it again. All right.
Okay. Well, I can just start back from where I started telling you about me, if you like.
Okay. We'll do that. Cause I try not to have too many slices in there. All right. So we'll start again at 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
So I did start very young in the environmental field. I always loved the environment, even going through high school into university. I did chemical engineering as an undergrad, but the environment sort of pulled me in. And I think my great uncle was the director of the Central Experimental Farm for Canada. And he always taught me that protection of the environment and protection of our resources is paramount for the future of life on Earth. So I always believe that the future of humanity is dependent on the greenness of the Earth. And that's where I focus my efforts as an environmental engineer, is helping people to do better by the environment. So now I work in the consulting field, where I'm basically advising companies and helping companies to solve their environmental issues and to do better on that green bottom line.
And is that a global thing that you're doing, or is that, you know, just primarily for Canada? Because you said you sit at the head of the table, you're the chair. So is that work that's done globally?
Well, there's two different companies there, April, and I've actually got a third environmental related company as well, which is a training organization. Locally in Sarnia, Ontario, is where I work in the field. So boots on the ground, spill response, you know, cleaning up messes, so to speak, and advising companies locally. The International Association of Environmental Professionals is an organization dedicated to upskilling environmental professionals for, you know, so that they can embrace different areas of their career and expand and develop their knowledge and skills for a really economical price. So that's the mandate of the International Association. So they're two completely different organizations. And then there's the training organization, which is EnviroTrain. And that's shifting over to all online, because obviously with COVID, the world has changed in the way we train people. So,
you know, what are we training people to do? Because they're not paying attention. You know, as I travel around the world, well, before COVID, I didn't see really a lot of, I don't know, effort to sustain what we have. Went to some countries, no recycling whatsoever. They're still burning plastic trash. We're concerned about the ozone layer. We're concerned about global warming. We're concerned about contaminated water. There's so many concerns. As you explained to me previously, is that some things are irreversible.
They absolutely are irreversible, you know, particularly like habitat loss. You can't come back from that once you've gone beyond a tipping point. And that's not just on, you know, terrestrial ecosystems. That's also marine and submarine ecosystems as well. Once they're damaged beyond a certain point, you can't retrieve that. So where we need to go, I think, as...
Let me kind of dial back to, for my brains that don't kind of understand where we are. So you're talking things like the coral reef. Or you're talking about things like the horrible burn that they had in Australia and the wildfires.
Yeah, and in the US, they've had similar horrible burns. And yeah, the coral reef and yeah, the mass deforestation, not just by fire, but also by using, you know, resources from the forests. And when we take away that, we're not just taking away the trees, we're taking away the whole ecosystem. So we're taking away the birds and the bees and the animals and the food sources that live there. So it's, you know, it gets to the point where it's, you can't come back from that. You can't replant new growth and say, okay, well, that ecosystem's going to regenerate, because that's taken, you know, hundreds or thousands of years to come to what it was. And then, you know, it gets taken away by, you know, in some cases you can't help a devastating weather incident or something, although there's a school of thought that would say that man is responsible for a lot of those devastating weather incidents as well. But if you, you know, if you're consciously going out and saying, well, I'm going to harvest that entire rainforest, or I'm going to deliberately pollute the coral reef, you're consciously making a choice to cause that pollution and to cause that damage and devastation. And, you know, if you look at refineries and chemical plants worldwide, you could say back then, you know, in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s, when everything was ramping up, they didn't know what the impact of their actions was going to be.
Right.
But we do know now. The knowledge is here now. And we're still making components like, you know, perfluoroalkylated substances, for instance. It's a big buzzword in certain communities that are being affected by it. But from other people's point of view, they're looking at it as, oh, Teflon and Scotchgard, and these things help me, therefore they're good. But we're not looking at the long-term effects of what those chemicals do to humans and to animals and to ecosystems. So, and some people are. Some people are looking at it and other people are not. So,
well,
it's really...
Some people are looking beyond it because they're getting paid on it. Let's talk about fracking. Fracking is big here in the United States now, and everyone is talking about it. It's big on the political agenda. you know, as far as sustainable energy and oils and gas. Tell us a little bit about that, what it does to the earth, and what is it?
Well, fracking is using basically high pressure fluid, in most cases water, sometimes other substances, to open up fissures in the ground and more easily release the oil and gas. So in a way, it's revolutionized the energy sector because it's now making it so much more economical to get out mass resources of oil and gas. So the communities are benefiting from that. They're benefiting from lower energy costs and increased, you know, work. There's a lot more work when you can actually extract resources from the ground and process them and sell them. So that's good for the economy. But at the same time, the damage to groundwater, surface water, ecosystems, and the harm from the air and water pollution coming from that is, you know, in my mind, it's a negative balance. Other people may disagree and say it's positive. You know, you get more from fracking than what you take away. But I wouldn't necessarily agree with that. I would say, you know, every community has to weigh it up. But from an environmental standpoint, I'm not a fan.
Well, and again, you are tapping into the core. I mean, the very core of the planet.
Right. Yeah. So you're sort of reaching into that. Yeah, definitely. I mean, you're not going down that deep, but you're definitely getting into things that if the earth wanted us to be in there, it would open up.
Wow. That's crazy. Talking about opening up, will you tell these people how you have done work down in the sewer? Now, okay, I saw the show, What Are America's Worst Jobs? And can you imagine this? This pretty thing right here with a helmet and hazmat suit down in the sewer, I would have had a fit, okay? Forget all of the feces and all the other stuff that's going through there. But let me see a family of rats, I'm done. What is the reason that you are down there? What are you doing? I mean, because I went to the, let me tell you this first, Braze, before I let her talk. I went to the new plant that we have here, recycling water. They told me that the water that goes through our pipes has been through those pipes about 385 times. And so what they're trying to do is they're trying to take sewer water and refine it to make it into regular drinking water that's going to go through our faucets here. And I just couldn't believe it. But then too, I don't know what's in bottled water. Okay. I haven't seen them manufactured. I haven't seen them tested. So tell me a little bit about number one, how in the world you got down there? Number two, what are you doing down there? And number three, what do we expect from what's down there?
Right. Okay, so there's a whole bunch of different questions there that I can address. But in terms of, you know, the plant that you went to visit, that's awesome that you went to visit it. I love hearing that because I really think that people need to become aware and educate themselves as to where their water comes from and what's going on in the state of the water world. Because the water cycle, you know, is a natural cycle where you have, you know, evaporation and then it rains, you know. So basically people look at that and say, oh, the clouds are bringing the rain. And that's bringing us water and that's going in the recharged groundwater. But what they're doing in a lot of areas of the world is recharging groundwater with sewage or treated sewage so that that can be reused. So, and there's all sorts of, you know, reclamation and reuse schemes for water because really the total amount of water that we have uncontaminated and available for drinking or not salty and available for use in, you know, in production and in agriculture and for our own personal needs, it's a finite amount and it's shrinking as we contaminate water. That amount of water that we have for our own use is shrinking. So, you know, looking at desalination and reclamation, they're awesome projects and really super fascinating. Now from the other questions in terms of sewers, my first job at a university as an engineer was in a wastewater treatment plant. And then from there, I was taking care of many small treatment plants. And then I moved into industrial wastewater as well. So, you know, working with human waste basically was certainly an eye-opener for a young recent graduate out of university. And yeah, you sort of get used to it. But what I did find going into that field, it's not just chemistry and it's not just environmental science, but it's also biology because, you know, you have all the bugs that are consuming. It's a natural process. Mm-hmm. You know, it's basically like the same way that a septic tank works is how most treatment plants work. And then with all the UV filtration and everything, they can get that water pretty clean. Not sure that I'm ready to drink it right out of the effluent line.
You know, I wasn't ready either. And they said, okay, it's time to test it. And I was like, oh, Lord. I said, I'm going to end up in the hospital.
But you didn't.
You know, I went in for brains. I took the bullet for you. And I tasted it. And I looked at the plant. And I looked at it. And, you know, they had compared it with bottled water. And their water, it looked a lot clearer and cleaner. And I'm saying, there's a lot of chlorine. There's a lot of bleach in here. What are they doing? But again, you don't know what you don't know. Okay, so now you're down there. And you're taking these samples. And you're coming back up and you're testing them. What is the purpose of that? What are you looking for?
For any quality testing, it depends on where you are, really. So in the treatment plants where I worked, the effluent line was discharging into the ocean. So it had to meet a certain quality standard. So the plant would, you know, basically take the samples off the effluent line and throughout the process to make sure that the process was running smoothly. And then at the other end where it's discharging into the ocean, you don't want to do more harm than good. You know, and in another conversation that you and I had, we were talking about licenses to pollute. And that's exactly the case. Like it's only illegal to pollute if you don't have a license to do so. And it's only illegal to release contaminants into the environment if you don't have a license to do so. But those licenses take into variables, considerations of what can the environment handle and naturally assimilate. So when you're discharging into the ocean, you've got, you know, your large body of water. So you have massive dilution. You have the sunlight and wind and wave action. So you have a lot of mixing. And then you also have the UV coming from the sun, which gives extra treatment. So in a way, the majority of what's going out there is getting treated further. If there's any contaminants left, it's getting treated further in some cases. In other cases, you have things like heavy metals or man-made substances like the PFAS that we talked about earlier, or chlorinated compounds that aren't necessarily easy to biodegrade and are not necessarily going to go anywhere depending on, you know, what surface water body or where they've been discharged. You know, in some places they take the biosolids, which is the solid component of the, you know, what's left over after all the water goes out, and they're spreading it on agricultural land, which is then growing, you know, food for animals or for people. So it's a never ending cycle.
It's a never.
And that's why we have to be cautious about what we're putting down the drain.
Well, okay. You look at a person, let's use an example that mops their floor. They put a little bleach, they put a little, you know, I don't want to use a particular product name, but you put some stuff in there to make it smell good and all that kind of stuff. And then they pour it right down the drain. Mm-hmm. Stuff is going right into the ocean. It's going right into the sewer. Or you look at the military ships. Yeah, I'm going to call you out military. Dumping over the side. All of their plastics. Just endless amounts. I just saw that they got 40 tons of plastic off the bottom of the ocean. That's just what they were able to harvest. That's not talking about what people were throwing in.
That's a drop in the bucket for what's in the ocean in terms of plastics and garbage and metals and glass waste. There's, the ocean has been a big dumping ground for a lot of years, which, you know, the ocean has a capacity to treat certain things. But some of the things that we dispose of as humans, like the packaging, you know, in some cases you buy products and it's wrapped 5 or 6 times and then it's put in a box and it's got, you know, styrofoam bubbles and then another box over top of it and then plastic wrap. And you think, why all this packaging? And, you know, in some cases it's food. You have individually boxed little things each wrap and then put together in a big box, all wrapped in plastic, and you go by and they put in a plastic bag and hand it to you as you walk out the door.
Right.
And, you know, really all you needed to do is just go buy a bag of raisins or get, you know, your food from the market and put it in your own recyclable bag.
That's okay. Here in the US, we have the recyclable bags. Okay. So now no plastic. They don't want styrofoam cups. They don't want the plastic bags, but you go in the grocery store, you can't take the plastic bag, but what do you do when you grab your produce? You take 10 or 15 plastic bags.
Plastic bags.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I don't do that anymore. I had a beautiful basket one of my African friends gave me. I shop in the basket. Plus, I feel like I'm kind of, you know, kind of European and kind of chic because I have this basket. But when I come home, I rinse my produce. I put it right in the drawer. It's no problem. I don't need the plastic bags. We can't have straws now. Now the straws are paper straws, which are horrible because it's all flimsy afterwards. So I don't even use a straw anymore. But those little basic things that people don't think about, like running the water, that's another thing. Don't waste water. Did she just explain to us about water brains? My niece will come here and brush her teeth. It seems like 5 minutes and the water is running for what? And I asked her, why are you running the water? Get a little cup of water, rinse your mouth, spit it out, and be done with it. I like the sound of the water. I told her, get over it.
So you need to get her one of those recycling waterfalls and just put that in the bathroom.
Put her hand under the water next time. Things like that, it just annoys me down into my core. These are some of the simplest things, and you can teach your children how not to be wasteful. You know, it's what we.
You know what my biggest pet peeve is with human behavior and the environment is littering. And flicking cigarette butts on the ground or spitting out gum on the ground. And you think, who raised you? Who raised you to do that?
Wow. Oh, no, you know what is really a killer? Now that we all have to wear these masks, I went for my walk this morning. I kid you not. Between here, the park, and back, I counted 22 masks.
No.
22.
That's ridiculous.
And I'm saying the purpose of this is to contain the virus and to dispose of it properly. Take the mask off and throw it in the trash. Plastic gloves, take them off and throw them in the trash.
In the trash. Yeah.
But when you throw them in the trash, they go to the landfill. Tell us a little bit about your knowledge of what goes on in a landfill. How do they decompose all of that to go back into the earth? Because, you know, you're putting your ketchup bottle in there, you're putting your relish things in there, you're putting your toothpaste in there. That stuff is not biodegradable.
No, generally it's not. So in some cities or some municipalities, they recycle a lot of those plastics and do a really good job of waste separation. In other cases, there's not a great separation. There's not necessarily the municipal budget to take care of doing that waste separation. So you wind up with everything just going into a landfill and then having the mass capped. And in that landfill, you have, you know, organisms working away at decomposing what it can. And that shrinks the mass. So then everything gets flattened down and more gets put on top and then capped again.
Okay, of course, when you say they put a chemical on top of that to help the decompose, the breakup?
No, not generally. Not generally a chemical. It's normally natural organisms that are present.
Really?
Yeah. So, and most of them are methane generating. Pardon me?
Glass can break down?
No, glass isn't going to break down. No, you're going to need to crush up that glass and recycle it.
Okay. All right. So, let's talk a little bit about that. And then we're going to carry on because I want my brain to really think about this because I'm a recycler, you know, and I look at my trash before I take it out. And you got to put a certain kind of plastic here and a certain kind of plastic there. But what has happened in the U.S. again is that we've made ugly with China and they are shutting down our recycling plants because we'll pack it up. We'll send it over to China. China will melt it down and do whatever they do. Send it back to us so that we can refill these containers once again. But now they're angry. So now they don't even want to take our recycling. So our recycling plants are closing down. So I look at that, and then I look at compost. I don't like the smell of garbage at all.
Nobody does. And maybe that's why it's being sent to China. But if you think about it, is that right, you know, to ship our waste or the U.S. waste overseas to be processed? I know there's a big not in my backyard philosophy that exists. People don't want to see that locally. But think about the fuel resources being consumed in shipping that waste over to China for reuse or for recycling. And, you know, recycling plants aren't necessarily difficult to design and build. And like I said, some municipalities are really great at separating waste and treating it independently and recycling what they can. Other municipalities are really great at having people separate their waste and then they throw it all together in the same landfill anyway, because they don't have the facilities in place yet to recycle it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that is interesting in and of itself. Then if you think that's just municipal solid waste, and in some cases, you know, we were talking about burning garbage earlier, in some cases, incineration with the right environmental emission controls is a better option than landfilling, which, you know, especially if you're harvesting the power from that and using it to, you know, make it completely energy neutral.
Right.
Same thing with the landfill, with the methane generating organisms, we're collecting the methane off of that and using that for power generation as well. So,
right, right. So let's talk about your trip to India.
Okay.
I was not, okay, brains, I'm gonna be honest with you. I wasn't mature enough to handle it. There was a lot going on over there. Okay. Beautiful people. Beautiful culture, beautiful jewelry, beautiful spirituality, but extreme poverty. I mean, extreme poverty. When you talk about stench of garbage, I couldn't get my head around it. I couldn't really even leave the hotel very much. In addition to that is that, you know, you see mounds and mounds and mounds of garbage that they are going through to try to salvage, to, for whatever reason, if they need it or trying to sell it or whatever, it's just incredible. And that's just one place. But beyond that, you found a healing because you were a woman with a brain tumor and you went to India. You went to India to do some Ayurveda medicine and to do a cleansing. Tell us a little bit about that.
Okay, so I went to a different part of India than you did. I was in the south of India in Kerala. And while this, you still see a lot of poverty there, it's a little bit different than the big cities in India. So I found it beautiful and really healing to be there. I like I said, I went for Ayurvedic treatment for a brain tumor that I had and no longer have, which makes me very happy. So I think that... that experience changed my life, and it changed the way that I look at everything in terms of how I do my work and how I schedule my day and what's important and what isn't in my life. And really, I found the meaning of life in India. And that, I know that sounds a little bit strange, but I believe we all have the same purpose here. We all are here to learn and grow and develop our talents and skills and our knowledge as much as we can and share that with as many people as we can. So I went to India as, you know, thinking of it as strictly medical treatment, going to an Ayurvedic clinic, and I was going to focus on my healing. And I left there with a really wide open conscious and like a whole new raft of experiences, including the knowledge that I can't eat Indian food.
Well, and I couldn't eat a cheeseburger because they honor the cow and I was hot about it. You know, like, you know, can I have a steak or something? No, we're not doing that, you know. But again, when you went through this process of healing and cleansing, not only was it spiritual, but you did a lot of physical things. Explain to us a little bit about that. Was a lot of meditation? Did you go through sweat lodges, massage?
Well, what kind Ayurvedic of treatment is really different for everybody and every condition. There are a lot of different facets for the physical aspect of Ayurvedic treatment, but the detox process is what I sort of went through. And yeah, it did involve, you know, a lot of heat and sweating and herbal treatments and massage. And it's, you know, not the massage that you go for to your local spa and have a nice friendly massage. It's pretty intense stuff. So there was a few days there that I was really, really sick. Really, I think because I'd had chemotherapy for a couple of years, there was a lot of a toxin buildup in my body that had to get out anyways. We don't want to talk about that anymore.
But you know, because there are people that are going to have to go through that.
So, absolutely.
You know, mm-hmm. and some mm-hmm. people come out stellar. You know, everybody's not the same. But
yeah, and I would really... I would definitely recommend it, looking into it, for anybody who has any health condition or mental health condition, because it's a three-legged stool. You know, it's like mind, body, and spiritual wellness. And that is the foundation of yoga, and it's the foundation of Ayurveda. So for me, it was life-changing. And out of that is where my book spawned. So being Canadian, I'm, you know, sort of naturally modest in terms of disrobing or not. And my book is called Getting Naked, because basically on the first day it was like, you know, drop your drawers and sit on the stool naked. And, you know, and there's people walking around, there's therapists. And I was like super uncomfortable. I'm sitting there like, oh, what's going on? So, you know, twice a day for a few weeks of that. And eventually you got used to getting naked. But while I was there, I really found I got used to it on a physical point of view, but I also was getting naked with myself in terms of stripping away all the layers of who I wasn't and who I thought I was supposed to be, but who I really wanted to be. And I think a lot of people go through life not even knowing what they want in their life or what they're here for. They just go through day by day by rote, because that's what they do until they die. And, you know, I think it was Benjamin Franklin that said most people live till 75, but they actually die at 25 or something along those lines. Wow. And it's true, because if you're not living a life worth living, you're not living your life at all. And I should write that down, actually. That's a pretty good quote.
Go and get your pen, because that's, you know, that's a quote. You can actually, you might be able to put that on a t-shirt.
There you go. I could. And I'll send it to you.
You know, but there's a lot. And I'm so glad that you were able to realize your vulnerability and embrace it. People don't want to admit that, you know, hey, I'm weak in a certain area, or I need to grow here, or this is something that I don't understand, or this is something that I'm afraid of. That is it. And that is what you do. Scientists ask the questions, brains. It's a never-ending cycle of asking the question and trying to figure out the answer, because we're solving and, changing. Yeah. But you are very science-based. And so there's a lot of people that, like when we started this conversation, we started talking about time. You said time is finite, you know, and I say it's an illusion, you know, because now is the perfect pause with COVID, okay? Everybody's brakes have been pumped. I don't care how pretty you are. I don't care how much money you have. I don't care who you know, your circle of influence. Everybody has to stop right now. What has this experience taught you?
Well, honestly, I think it's not just necessarily a pause. It was kind of a huge slap in the face in terms of you're not in control of where you can travel or where you can go. You know, there's things that are happening outside of our control that, you know, we may have thought that we had under control or in perfect control or had a say in. And I think those things, it's been a bit of a rude awakening to realize that, oh, I can't just hop on a plane and, you know, travel overseas if I want to. And, you know, I can't go to my grocery store and not wear a mask. I can't have 50 people over for Thanksgiving. You know, I saw a thing on Facebook that was, you know, I can have 30 people at a funeral, but only 6 at my table for Thanksgiving. So I'm going to have a funeral for my turkey, which is,
well, that's, you know, that was cute.
It was worded better than that, but it was pretty funny. But, you know, for me, I'm still working. I'm still running businesses. I'm still writing reports. I'm still doing the things that I always did. But in the middle of COVID, I actually wound up having a series of operations on my ovaries and stuff. So that's a conversation for another day. But so there was a lot of healing, you know, a lot of physical healing for me this year as well. And now I'm, you know, I'm in perfect health and I'm happy and I'm charging full steam ahead.
You say, as you Canadians say, I'm 100. I'm 100 right now.
Yeah.
Okay. So you
but.
And you're learning?
I'm always learning. I'm learning something every day. If I pass a day without learning something, I'm really, really disappointed. But I feel like everyone has an opportunity right now to reinvent themselves, to really get naked with themselves and figure out what they want and how to get it, how they can develop and grow and be the best version of themselves and how they can share that with as many people as possible. Because everyone has something of value. You know, if you're open to receiving, when you meet someone and if you sit back and you don't talk about yourself, but you start asking questions about them, you're going to learn something regardless. And that's what, you know, God only gave us one mouth and two ears so that we can absorb more than what we put out there.
Exactly. All right. So this is an airborne virus. What do you think? And I'm, again, this is your opinion, my opinion. Brains, you do what you want to do, because I know what I'm going to do. It's an airborne virus. Pro-mask, anti-mask. Right? The way our physical body is, the way that we eat, the way that we process. But you have been able to travel the world, and you've been very fortunate that you've been able to go to a faraway land and get the best medical treatment. And you have had the best education, and that you are sitting at the head of the table as a woman making decisions on environmental issues. But what do you say to the underserved and overlooked that don't have the privileges that you've had as a woman? And as they call it here in America, the white privilege. What do you say to those people that are struggling?
Right. Well, I honestly don't know that being a woman in the field that I'm in is an advantage, because it's always been, you know, especially graduating in the 90s when it was always an old boys club. So pushing through as an engineer, female engineer, young, was never an easy fight. And I think that's probably where a lot of my illness came from. Well, no, that's not entirely right. I think when I was in India, stripping away those shells and that hard exterior, I think that hard exterior came from having to always prove myself as a woman, that I'm competent to be an engineer, and I'm competent to not just be an engineer, but to be your engineer and to give you good advice on how to manage your environmental issues. Pardon me. But I think from the point of view of privilege in terms of, you know, going through schooling, I paid for my own education going through, and I did that because I scooped ice cream when I was 13 years old and socked money into the bank. And, you know, I came from a split family where my mom didn't have a lot of money for us growing up, my sister and I, and definitely very privileged to have grown up in Canada and attended university in Canada, and very privileged to have, you know, spent so much time in Australia working and living there. But I think in a lot of cases, you can either let your situation keep you down, or you can get out of that situation through your own actions. And persistence is key, and having an open mind is key, and taking advantage of opportunities as they're presented to yourself. Because you don't need to have a lot of money to get a university degree. You don't need to have a university to get the knowledge that comes behind that degree. So you might need the degree to do certain jobs, but other jobs or other careers or other paths, you don't necessarily need to have a piece of paper from a university. And all of that knowledge is available in libraries and on the internet. Really, like the Google has opened up, you know, so many doors. We didn't have Google when I was a kid.
Right. We were looking at the encyclopedia.
Encyclopedia Britannica.
Your family had to purchase that, and they had to make payments sometime to get it.
That's exactly true. It was like the family heirloom, you know, the encyclopedia got passed down, and every year there was an update book. Yeah. You know, I remember our first computer was like, I don't know what it was, but it, like probably a 186 or something, and this clunky old thing, and you know, you could program a man skiing down a hill, and that's basically all I could do with it, or make colorful pictures.
Or the cell phone was a brick. Yes, we're dating ourselves, brains. You know, like my Jamaican friends say, you can have as many degrees as a thermometer and still not know what temperature it is.
Yeah, you're 100% right. Yeah.
So, you know, you have to do the work, brains. Nobody's going to do it for you. Everybody thinks that, you know, I'm going to take care of you. It's about survival. And, you know, God blesses a child that's got his own. Thank you so much for being here, Jennifer Golf, on The Edge with us. Please tell my brains how to get in contact with you. When that book is out, this is the first place. I want the exclusive.
All right. You got it.
I want people to know what is inside the pages of that book, because you are you're tough. You're tough. You're not sloppy seconds at all. And I'm so
thanks, April. I appreciate that. You're not sloppy seconds either, sister.
You know,
but to get in contact with me, go ahead.
No, no, go ahead. Tell us how to get in contact with you.
To get in contact with me, you can find me at, or email me at jenny@jennygoff.com. So that's jenny@jennygoug.com. or go to my new website for my Think Elite program, which is all about higher level thinking for brains. And that's think-elite.net. So you can find me there. And thank you again for that conversation.
And I am so glad that you are here and that you are well.
Me too.
Feeling good, and that you're doing the work that you do, not only for you, but for the entire planet.
Thank you. I hope that even just a tiny iota of what I do makes a difference to the planet, because that has been my life's mandate, is to learn as much as I can about the earth and help it as much as I can in terms of, you know, providing advice or cleaning things up or training others to do it.
You gave me some great tips, some things that I'm looking at now. I'm not sure if I really kind of want the water from the treatment plant, but I'm here. I survived it and I didn't get, you know, diarrhea.
So, oh, that's good. That's good. But you know, there are places in the world that's their water source. You know, they're taking it directly out of rivers where upstream someone's dumping into it. So they don't have the privilege of treatment plants. So that's
they're doing it right here in Mexico. You know, mm-hmm. We get notices all the time that the water is contaminated, that the sewer is spilling over into our oceans. You can't go surfing. You can't go to the beach for days. Mm-hmm. But the ecosystem, as you said, as the tide comes in and goes out, it washes it, it purifies it. But how long is that going to last? How long is it?
Well, that's the thing. Once it reaches the tipping point, it can't do it anymore. You know, it's just like the human body. Once you've pushed it beyond its capacity, it can't heal from a certain point, you know?
Right.
So we have to take care of ourselves. We have to take care of each other. And we have to take care of the earth.
Yep. And the body dies, but the spirit lives on. And thank you for being the spirited person here with me on the edge. You are awesome sauce. Brains, I ask that you go in and subscribe to everything, especially the YouTube channel, because we've got almost 300 episodes, okay? And I need to have thousands, thousands, and thousands more people connecting with that. Go back and check Edgy Conversations on Blog Talk Radio. You can find us on iTunes, LinkedIn, all over the planet, and Facebook. Again, go out and check out Jenny's stuff, because she's super smart. I love you guys from the bottom of my socks, because my heart just isn't deep enough. Bye.
Farewell.